This show is about spoilers and discussion. It's also about spooky things that are best enjoyed after you see the movie. So any movie we talk about, we recommend you go see. You've been warned.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
The horror. There is no shortage of monsters to haunt our dreams.
The horror.
You got red on you.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
The horror.
Alive, it's alive.
Groovy.
Hello again and welcome to Oh the Horror, a podcast about classic and modern horror films from a casual and an expert's perspective. I am the casual Steve Allman.
And I'm the expert Rob Holmes.
And we've got a bang-up job of a movie today.
Oh yeah, this one is fantastic. It is the Stuart Gordon classic, 1985's Reanimator.
We are going to be taking a look at this classic 80s gore fest. I think you can...
It's a total gore fest, yeah.
Yes, this was a very, very special film. One that I've actually seen four times since you've actually recommended it to me now. Yeah, Rob, this movie's great.
It's pretty fantastic. I mean, it's a movie that definitely pushed the limits in 1985 of what you're able to do on a very, very limited budget. Gory as all hell... lots of crazy practical effects that were thrown into it. Definitely put H.P. Lovecraft and his work more on the cinematic map, because I feel like that was something that was underutilized at the time.
And it Lovecraft actually is very underutilized. You don't often get to see movies that are based on, or even loosely based on, his work a lot of the time.
Unless they're directed by Stuart Gordon.
Exactly.
And he definitely picked up on a lot of that stuff later on. In the late 80s and the early 90s, you had more H.P. Lovecraft stuff, Necronomicon, and then, you know, Bride of Reanimator, Beyond Reanimator, still kind of following suit with that.
Riding those great coattails.
Absolutely. And there were some other things throughout there. Dagon, which Stuart Gordon did. He did a lot of stuff that... I feel that H.P. Lovecraft was a huge inspiration for most of his work.
And Lovecraft is actually takes a lot of inspiration from classic horror and monster writers of the time, and gave his own sort of science fiction-y celestial twist on it, and that seems to show a lot in these Stuart Gordon horror films as well. Being kind of one of the better ones.
By far one of the better ones. A lot of the time when people do any sort of film that relates to H.P. Lovecraft, a lot of them do fall apart. They're not very good. They've tried to do some Cthulhu films, and that has not really worked out too well.
It's a shame, because that's a bang-up job of a story. Anyway, that just makes me mad. But let's get into some of the great stuff that's in this movie.
So basically, the plot of this film is there is a medical student, Dan Kane, played by Bruce Abbott, and his girlfriend, Megan Halsey, who is the daughter of the dean, played by Barbara Crampton. They become involved in these weird experiments when this student, who had been studying in Switzerland under a doctor named Dr. Hans Gruber, diehard reference.
Yes.
Ends up being reanimated and dies, but this guy, Herbert West, arrives on campus in Arkham, Massachusetts, at Mesotonic College or Mesotonic Hospital.
Mesogeneric, please, university that does not sue us.
Right.
So University of Generica.
Herbert West appears, having, you know, used some sort of serum in the beginning, saying that he gave this guy life. When the doctor's eyes explode right in the beginning of the film, right away you know you're getting into some crazy shit. You know that shit is about to hit the fan. Herbert West shows up. You're wondering, how is this guy not in jail? Sure, okay, why not? He's a dick right off the bat. He's a total douchebag.
Well, we see this movie, it begins with basically a guy's head more or less imploding on itself.
Right, eyes bursting out and then bleeding out everywhere. But the second Herbert West shows up, he's a condescending bastard towards... there's a doctor there, Dr. Carl Hill, who's played by David Gale. Right off the bat, he says that Hill's experiments in dealing with brain death from lasting 6 to 12 minutes is totally arbitrary, and derivative of Dr. Hans Gruber's, some would say even plagiarized.
And keep in mind, this guy is like just a little bit older than us. I would say like in probably in his early 30s, it looks like. And he's talking up guys that are like in their 50s.
Yeah,
have been dedicating their life's work to these things.
And he's talking shit to people right away because he's so damn cocky. So right away, we're introduced to Herbert West. Herbert West decides, you know, Dan Cain's looking for a roommate. So Herbert West all of a sudden just shows up at his door one day and is like, hey man, I'm going to be your roommate. Here's some cash. Let me move in. Megan's like, dude, no, do not. Maybe you should think about this, Dan. But then the cash is right there. And Dan, being as naive as he is, says, okay, man, yeah, you can totally move in here. You seem like a weird guy, but I don't care, money.
He's eccentric, and that's...
He's eccentric to say
the
least.
But he also pays rent, so that's all he cares about.
And what's interesting about this film is that when you watch it, you're wondering who the bad guy is. Because right off the bat, it does seem like Herbert West. Yet Herbert West, as far as the Reanimator series goes, people don't really see him as the bad guy.
I mean, he certainly gives off a very much of an antagonistic sort of vibe because he is there kind of messing with the systems of pretty much everybody that's in this world.
He's the anti-hero, when you think about it, because if it weren't for Herbert West, none of the bad shit that happens in this film would happen.
No, and one of the two maybe good things that would have happened didn't happen. I don't think anything good that can be lasting for more than 5 minutes in this movie actually happens because of Herbert West. So he kind of is the bad guy, but it also kind of is his story in a weird way.
It is his story in a way. I feel like it's Dan's story.
I mean, yes,
for the most part.
Like Dan is the surrogate of the audience.
Right,
basically.
Right.
He
so
is
Dan
the one that's
the...
like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
So Dan's like the everyman. He's engaged to Megan Halsey, the dean's daughter. You know, they're trying to be kind of not too quiet about the relationship, but like she's always saying that she has to go home and stuff. And
yeah,
you know,
keep it a little under wraps.
Keep it a little under wraps because you know he has his scholarship and he doesn't want to lose it or anything like that.
I think the line expressly was, get your doctorate and then I'll marry you.
Yeah.
That's the reason. Like, let's get rid of all of this school business and then we'll get serious.
So she's not under the thumb of her dad anymore and then they can kind of escape together and they're off doing their own thing. Well, basically Herbert West, played by Jeffrey Combs, the amazing Jeffrey Combs, he is absolutely
this
awesome.
This dude's great.
He's fantastic. If you've ever seen The Frighteners, you know that he's one hell of an actor.
I do need to see The Frighteners.
You definitely need to see The
Frighteners.
Talking about The Frighteners. The second Herbert West shows up, shit kind of hits the fan right away. You know, he shows up into class, Dr. Hill is teaching in there, and Herbert West, like, right away is questioning authority and challenging authority. He just snaps his pencil during the middle of a lecture.
Probably the worst way to taunt somebody, I think. You're just like, meh.
Yeah, and it's during the scene, like... Hill is peeling a scalp back where he says it's like peeling back a large orange. And everyone laughs because I guess that's what med students do.
I think med students are in a weird way that perverse about just the human body. Like,
right. It's that gallows humor.
Well, I've been afraid of doctors sometimes because like in my high school days of just being morbid and not
right.
I'm like, man, doctors are just murderers that are just have degrees. That's all they're good for. Like they take just as much pleasure. And then I'm like, no. They're professionals. They want to help people.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fine.
Except in this film where it does kind of seem like
they're grisly murdering
people. So Hill has been using some sort of lobotomizing laser that we learn about in the beginning of it. And we'll kind of touch base on that in a little bit. But he is peeling back the scalp of one of these people. He's doing a bone saw into it, pulls out a brain, showing everybody and says, you know, the brain death will happen within 6 to 12 minutes. Herbert West snaps a pencil, snaps another pencil, and then Dr. Hill says, I recommend that you bring a pen from now on, Mr. West.
That's more, again, of that condescending doctor humor that's just
right.
Like, there's too intellectual to just be like, man, fuck you.
But then, you would think that it would end there, but then Herbert calls him out right away at the end of the lecture in front of all these students. Just calls him out in front of everyone. So he's not really helping himself in any way.
No.
So at this point, we go back to Dan Cain's place. The cat who has been there in the beginning of the film and kind of around has disappeared.
I love this plot with a cat.
This
is the true subplot of
it is
the
really
Reanimator,
kind of
is this crazy cat.
This crazy cat who we get in the beginning, and Megan is over at Dan's place, and Desai, you know, is trying to find this cat. Somehow, I guess, doesn't hear the cat, but just decides to go into Herbert's room, and the fridge is sitting open, and there's a dead cat in there, which was actually a real dead cat. They used an actual dead cat for that scene.
Yeah, and which would never happen now.
Which would never happen now. And, you know, you see the serum and everything in there, and then Herbert says to him when he's confronted, "What did you expect? A note that said cat dead, details later?"
Yeah.
And that ended up becoming a huge thing about that film. Like, there's t-shirts with that printed on it. There's posters that have that.
That's like, again, I have known people that have made jokes like that, that they're not just funny, but they're just socially awkward enough to just be like, that's their version of a joke.
Right, right. But at this point, you're wondering, like, who the hell is this guy? Did he just kill this cat? And he said that the cat suffocated, but you know that he had to have killed this cat.
Well, he clearly strikes me as this 80s amalgamation of the mad scientist, but also this hoity-toity intellectual type,
right,
translated into what must have been then just a brash kind of dick. He's a dick.
Yeah. Oh, he's a total dick. And, you know, we find out that later on that night, I think, Dan hears some noises. He goes downstairs and he sees that his cat has been brought back to life and is attacking Herbert. And
yeah.
Herbert has this cat just on his back, scraping away at him. And it becomes this comedy of errors trying to kill this cat again. And he does, and he's like, "What the hell have you done to my cat?" And he's like, "Well, he was dead." No, he wasn't dead. You must have just kept him in the fridge and made him look like he was dead. He's like, "No, you see how he's dead right now? Totally split in half, pretty much.
Right, yeah.
You can tell his back is broken." Mm-hmm. Injects him with the serum, a reanimator serum, and the cat comes back to life again.
By the way, that perfect green 50s goo that
was actually glow stick liquid.
Of course. Yeah. And that's picture perfect, because I love just that iconic look of the mad green. But like the key art for this entire movie, like even that one sheet that you would see on Netflix,
right,
it's that amazing, like kind of just like 50s Vincent Price kind of look.
Yeah.
Where you just see the big green vial and then the mad scientist looking up with his white lab coat.
Right.
Like, it's very retro,
yeah,
in a lot of respects, and this movie's kind of going for a lot of that.
Oh, it definitely does. I mean, that was basically the entire premise for coming up with the film.
It's a throwback.
A total throwback. It was basically because Stuart Gordon, when he was in film school, was talking about, you know, there's too many Dracula films out there. There's not enough of these Frankenstein-type films. It's too much Dracula, Dracula, Dracula. And one of his buddies said, "Well, you know, you're a huge H.P. Lovecraft fan, just make Herbert West Reanimator into a film." But the story had gone out of print, so Gordon hadn't read it, but found a copy at the Chicago Public Library, and once he read it, he knew that that was the story that he wanted to tell.
And that's a fun fact that you mentioned, the inspiration from Frankenstein and Lovecraft, because Lovecraft was actually inspired to write Reanimator based off Frankenstein from Mary Shelley.
Right.
And he basically kind of made it so that the story of Frankenstein was a lot less poetic and a bit more perverse and messed up.
Absolutely.
And it's kind of a perfect marriage of all three of these inspirations.
So at this point in the film, we kind of get introduced to our real villain of the film, and we've already been introduced to him. We start to understand that Carl Hill has a strange obsession with Megan. Like a really perverse obsession with Megan.
I mean, he's just creeping on her.
Like, he's totally creeping on her the entire time. So what happens, pretty much a quick rundown of everything that happens kind of in this film, is that Dan Cain goes to Dean Halsey and says that Herbert's formula works. The dean says, "All right, you're done. Your scholarship is pulled. I don't want you here anymore. You're insane," just like that Herbert West. But I'm thinking, you let Herbert West come here to begin with, and now you're saying that the guy's insane.
Clearly we needed to get some money from somebody, just be like, "Hey, we got this hot, young, acclaimed doctor.
Yeah.
And please give us grant money or something."
Something like that.
Yeah.
So they decide to resurrect the body, or they're going to see if they can. And the thing that gets me about this is that when they go down into the morgue and Herbert decides he's going to inject a body with the reanimator formula, he's like, "All right," I think he says 10 cc's or something to it, and he injects it into the back of the neck of the guy.
He does not know how much 10 cc's is.
He knows how much it is. He injects him with the 10 cc's, then says, "It's not working. I'm going to up the dose to 20 cc's. Not add an extra 10 cc's in. another 20 on top of it. The guy finally does wake up and goes crazy, and he had just had, like, basic heart failure, I think, was the only thing that was wrong with the body.
Right.
But the guy is ripped and built and just...
They get, like, basically Andre the Giant to be reanimated.
They get this
the
giant
time.
Dude to come in there, knocks down the door, crushes Dean Halsey, bites his fingers off. Dean Halsey, at this point, is dead, but they reanimate him and make him look like he went insane. So now, right. Megan... I have to say, this film is basically, if you were to say who is the most tortured person in this entire movie, it is Megan Halsey.
Oh, for sure.
She goes from having this life that could have been perfect to having her father killed, brought back to life. Carl Hill decides to lobotomize him later so he can control him.
Her boyfriend gone on this crazy wild ride with a scientist.
Yeah, boyfriend has decided to go on this strange Frankenstein, like, messing with dead bodies, bringing things back to life.
Misadventures,
ruining everything that they had or everything that they could have had. And in the end, you know, she's the object of Carl Hill's obsession. With Carl Hill later comes and tries to
basically sexually assault her in a
so he's already obsessed with her and tries to steal Herbert's formula. Herbert kills him and then right away decides to bring not only his head that he's decapitated from him back to life, but also his body, which was a dumb idea. But Herbert doesn't seem like the type who really rationally thinks through everything. So now you have Dr. Hill, his body and his head, which have been separated, moving around, in control of everybody.
Right.
Because he's lobotomized a ton of the dead bodies already, but reanimated all of them, so he has control over every single one of them.
Yeah.
And gets the father, the Dean, Dean Halsey, the lobotomized version, to kidnap Megan so he can essentially sexually assault her.
It's all very, very involved.
It's very involved. It's very creepy. It's super fucked up.
I think one of the best things that I've noticed was that when our actual villain kind of actually starts to get his claws into the reanimated father and starts to pull at her strings a bit, we actually get to see a lot more of Herbert West trying to be the hero that he should be.
Yeah.
Only because it's out of ego and rivalry from another doctor trying to steal his shit. Even if he is the victim of, like, ends up being the victim of his serum.
It's like he wants to help Dan. It's like he's trying to be a good guy to help Dan
out.
It's almost like he's trying to help Dan out. I mean, it's always for his own benefit of some sort, but he's always pulling Dan along for the ride by saying, you know, we can bring these people back. We can do this. This is how we'll get out of trouble. Let's just inject this person, and then it'll prove that we brought someone back to life.
He's very good at that desperate coercion just to get somebody to do something that he wants.
Right.
And that's where it stops. Like, if Dan was in the way of him being either famously recognized or completing an experiment, he'd off him in a second.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where part of me wonders why Dan really goes along with this the entire time, except
you can't
for the fact
clearly
that
see through that.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. When you're watching this film, you're just thinking to yourself, Dan, what the hell are you thinking, man? Your life was perfect, and you just keep letting it get worse and worse and worse and worse. So basically, the film gets to a point where Dr. Hill has kidnapped Megan. They have to save the day. He's got an army of dead bodies that are working with him on that. By the end of it, it looks like Herbert West has met his doom because he decides to do an overdose onto Carl Hill's body. Dr. Hill's body has been, or Dr. Hill's head has been destroyed by the Dean. The Dean gets ripped into pieces. And then it looks like that's it. It looks like, you know, Herbert has died. Everyone else has died. Megan and Dan are going to make it through. One of the corpses somehow gets out and chokes out Megan and kills her. Dan tries to save her in time, but he runs all the way down a hall to grab an axe to cut off the arm of this dude.
The cacophonously long hallway.
So ridiculous.
So I love the design of that set because this is clearly like the biggest, widest morgue and the biggest, widest hallway.
Oh, yeah. And so he runs all the way down there, cuts a guy's arm off. She's dead. And just like in the beginning of the film, he's trying to resuscitate a patient. And as the nurse says, you know, you don't know when to quit. Sometimes, like, this person's already dead.
Mm-hmm.
You need to stop. I know you're passionate about, like, wanting to save lives, but this is too much. And he does the same thing with her. He's always wanting to make sure he can save that life. He wants to especially with her at the end, with Megan, he wants to save her. Well, he has the formula with him, and the first thing he thinks is, well, she's dead. I know it hasn't worked at all yet in the film.
But?
But, and he goes to inject her, and then it goes to that cool silhouette, and then you just see the green formula, and he injects it into her, and you hear her scream, and right. The film ends.
Film ends. And that's a super cool ending, and I think that Dan's overall arc is, like, it's only bookended in the movie.
Right.
We get that he's very, very passionate about wanting to save lives, and I think that's the only thing that you could kind of extrapolate as to why he would go along with West this entire time, because maybe he tries to see the overall help that this thing could do, but he's just kind of driven crazy by, like, he's clearly misjudged this, for sure.
Clearly misjudged this.
Yes.
He got in way over his head and then could not get out.
No. So, there are so many great things that happen in this movie that make it easily understandable as to why it's a classic.
Oh, yeah.
Mainly of the makeup effects.
Mm-hmm.
All of the gore effects. We've talked before about Dead Alive and how those were kind of just bonkers and insane. These were a bit more grounded in reality.
These were all based on actual deaths. So there was the shotgun to the face one where the guy's missing half of his face. There's someone who is a burn victim or a road rash victim, and you can see how the bodies are torn up. You're looking at when they say, like, oh, there's this guy, he's a meatball under there, and then you see Herbert go in, and it's like, no, here's your meatball. And
this was
the guy who got, you know, like, road rash or in a terrible automobile accident. Yeah, all of the bodies definitely look like they have been natural cause deaths or deaths that could really happen. And being brought back to life, you know,
in a bit of a surreal way. Because yes, we say it's cartoony because we have a reanimated head on a spike.
Sure, yeah.
But it's also taken from the fact that it's done in a way that isn't like in Dead Alive, where we'd have some sort of like slapsticky happenstance with it.
I mean, there's a little slapstick, like when Hill's trying to control his body and his body keeps running into stuff and it's just falling around everywhere and doing things like that. I mean, it's a comedy horror, but the comedy is a little more subdued and way darker, and definitely not as you said, slapsticky or cartoony as something like Dead Alive.
It's almost like black slapstick, where that could sound racy.
It's super dark comedy.
Yeah, it is dark comedy.
It's like pitch black comedy.
It's very situational, because after having this very intense scene about, like, fighting about with West and the doctor about the ethics of the serum, and then he kills him with a shovel, and then he's just trying to prop his head up.
Yeah.
And he's just like, boom, boom, and then he gets a spike and just pop.
Yeah.
That's unintended horror, and it's very brief, but it's a lot of levity in that scene, for sure.
This is a crazy movie, and it's strange because the budget was only $900,000 for this movie, and it ended up grossing around $2 million, so it did all right. I mean, it wasn't, you know, a huge, huge success, but for the fact that, you know, it doubled what it cost to do, I would say that's probably pretty successful.
It made its money back, for sure.
I mean, it had two sequels, 1989's Bride Reanimator and then Beyond Reanimator in 2003. Their producer, Brian Usna, directed both of those. Not a fan.
Not a fan of any of those.
Well, no. Beyond Reanimator's all right. Bride of Reanimator, I watched that again this morning. And, you know, a lot of stuff doesn't hold up in between the two films.
Right.
So at the end of the first one, Dr. Hill's head is destroyed. Yet it is perfectly preserved in the sequel.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Combs' character is supposedly dead at the end of the first one. Yet is totally alive in the second one.
I'm starting to realize that continuity, at least between sequels of horror films, are kind of the one thing that gets a little
thrown
out the window.
It takes place eight months later. So 8 months later, they're in Peru and still doing their experiments on stuff. I would have to say the fact it had a $2 million budget, but the production value looked way less than the original Reanimator.
Interesting.
It just didn't have the same cool qualities to it. It felt more like a jumbled mess. I mean, there's definitely a lot more creature effects and a lot more stranger things that they try to do with that, like reanimating individual body parts.
Right.
And it is a Bride of Frankenstein type movie. That's the whole premise for it. It's creating another, you know.
Yeah, and again, person. Taking that inspiration from Frankenstein. But again, a thing that makes it differ, at least from Frankenstein, or at least even traditional zombie movies, mm-hmm. You've mentioned this before, is that in this movie, the zombies seem to want sex.
Yeah, so...
They don't actually want, like, flesh or...
Right.
Well, they want flesh in the more...
They want flesh in
the sexual.
In the carnal way. Yeah, they... And Dr. Hill definitely gets very creepy with Megan in the film. I mean, he's making out with her a bit, or kissing her body, and then tries to go down on her. Just his head. Just his severed head. But luckily, Herbert West shows up just in time to save the day. It's very creepy the way he is, but that's kind of the way that Carl Hill was the entire time.
Oh, yeah.
His strange obsession with Megan, and that's... Actually, that brings up an interesting fact. So, there's a lot of subplots that got cut out of this movie that kind of bring in more continuity into the sequel and kind of make things make a little more sense when you watch them together.
Okay.
Originally, Dr. Hill had the ability to do mind control.
Just had it before any of this
somehow,
went down.
Somehow, he was able to mind control people, and there's a scene that was deleted where he's talking with Dean Halsey. He basically hypnotizes him into thinking that Herbert West and Dan Cain are bad, like that they're
bad people
and that they need to be stopped. So that makes more sense into the fact when Dan goes to the dean and says, yes, Herbert's been doing this stuff, why the dean is so standoffish and telling him, like, yeah, you can tell Herbert that he's done here and doesn't, you know, he's not going to be a student and your scholarship has been revoked. So that part makes a little more sense. When he goes to Herbert and tells him, you know, you're going to give me your journal, you're going to give me your notes, Herbert looks at him and he has this strange look at it, and he hands it over like it's like he is being hypnotized a
right.
little. And when he has Megan tied down in the beginning and he starts talking to her about stuff, she calms down very quickly. So that was a subplot that they just somehow excised from the film, but that was originally one of the plot points that they had in there.
Interesting. And when it comes into his, you know, influence on the zombies, at least in the first one, we can see that they actually reflect his sexual desires, and that's kind of what's being projected out onto the zombies.
Yeah, when the bodies come up, so he's lobotomized them all so he can have better control over their minds, but when he says, I've got a surprise for you, and all of the bodies end up shooting up.
Yeah.
It's because Dr. Hill has the ability to do that. It's how he can control his body as well.
Where that kind of just happens, like, almost nonsensically in
right.
the movie.
In the film, yeah, if you don't know the context of it or where it originally came from, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but you kind of just let it go because the
You're
movie
like, oh, well,
in
it's
itself
a,
is
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, it's a weird serum. I guess you can mind control with that.
Right.
Like, it's a suspension of disbelief that you can kind of go with.
And then another weird subplot was that originally Herbert West was injecting himself with small doses of the serum in order to stay awake and keep his brain super sharp. I guess they cut that out because that seems a little strange to do, the fact that he would inject himself with his own reanimation serum.
I mean, that doesn't exactly make sense as to what the reanimation serum should do.
Right.
I mean, it's supposed to, like, preserve, like, brain death or prevent brain death, sleeping, surely your brain's still going. Like,
right.
The science of that isn't exactly sound, but again, like,
but
you could
that
out.
It could show why he is a little off-kilter and as crazy as he is, if he's using his own stuff that he's doing to try and bring people
getting
back to life.
Getting high off his own supply,
yeah.
For sure.
And then the original ending showed the results of Megan coming back to life.
Yeah.
So she was revived, she kisses Dan, but then has a heart attack. It looks like her neck snaps to the side very strangely, and she dies again. Then we find out Herbert didn't die. He appears again, and he says Dan thought that Hill had killed him, and Wes says that Hill didn't have the guts. Another tongue-in-cheek joke, because it was Hill's intestines that were choking him out at the end of the film. But then Dan asks West if he can still bring Megan back. And so they're going to try and bring her back again. And that's how the original cut of the film ended. So there was a lot that that did get cut out of even the unrated version.
Do we know why?
I am not exactly
Probably studio
sure.
interference, I'm guessing. They wanted a more concise ending. They wanted
you
something
know,
more definite.
I think it was just to kind of... Yeah, maybe. I mean, so there's three cuts of the film total. There's a 95-minute R-rated theatrical cut. So the gore is removed, but there's extra scenes that are added into the film. There's the 86-minute unrated director's cut, where the gore is restored and the extra scenes are removed for pacing issues.
I mean, sure, yeah.
This is a rare thing to happen. Normally in a director's cut, they go longer, but in this case, they decided to shorten it up to keep it a tighter film.
I don't quite understand that balance still, but yeah.
I mean, it's strange. And then there's a 104-minute extended cut known in Germany as the Integral Cut. All scenes have been added. So everything
all,
is back
all of these versions, director approved and made, correct?
Not necessarily director approved and made. I mean, no. We're talking about the MPAA coming in, especially for what was done, because it did have a theatrical release in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I think for the unrated version, it was like, all right, well, let's keep the pacing going a little better. Let's make sure that, you know, it's a faster film. Because otherwise, I could see it if it is going at 96 minutes or 95 minutes, which really doesn't seem that bad. I guess it slowed it down or bogged it down a bit.
You could. And I'd be more inclined to believe your assessment that it kind of fell prey to the MPAA, because they were hacking up a lot of horror films
in the 80s.
Back in the day.
Yeah, in the 80s, all they did was hack up the films, and that was a big thing for them, just to get in there and butcher anything they could down to the minimal amount of blood and gore, because this was new. Mm-hmm. So late 70s, early 80s, this type of on-screen violence didn't really exist.
It was a pioneering time for a lot of these effects and a lot of these, like, you know,
which is why it was
scenes.
One of the best times around, because it was all practical effects. You were able to really push the limits of what could be shown on film, but things did get cut after a while. Like, some of this stuff was able to come out in the late 70s, early 80s, and then the MPAA comes in and is like, nope, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, which is why some of the films later on, probably, I would say, around 85 through 89, a lot of them are tamer or had a lot of the gore cut out. Sometimes you can find director's cuts of them, but a lot of the time, some of that ended up on the cutting room floor, and only now are we actually able to find some of those scenes and have them restored into their films, if they were even able to keep those pieces. Because sometimes they were told throw them away and scrap them.
Right. Which is a horrendous waste and an unfortunate one.
You know, when Stuart Gordon was making this film, his philosophy is, you know, don't censor yourself. And then Brian Yuzna, you know, he wanted to push the gore to its limits, but wanted it to be scarier than it actually was, because it was Stuart Gordon who wanted that comedy element to it. But I think that Stuart Gordon was right in that, because if you had just made this a pretty dark horror film without any element of comedy in it whatsoever, I don't really think it would have worked.
Most likely not. It seemed to be that it kind of straddled the balance between camp and so horror thriller, I guess you could say. It straddled the line pretty well that, while some movies would have made it like a bit of a middle of the road experience overall, it made it a very nice balance, because it got kind of crazy near the end, but it was a bit of a romp on the way there, and that's kind of refreshing.
Yeah,
because you don't get to see at least the balance of that being held well.
Yeah, I think the 85-minute version kind of does work pretty well, because it's very tight, fast paced, gets to the point, scene follows scene follows scene, with, you know, not a lot of straggling in between it. I think adding in the mind control stuff, while that's fine for the R-rated version, and having in more of a subplot and everything like that, sometimes you just want a fast-paced thrill ride.
You do. And regardless of your type of pace or your speed for horror film, I think this has something for everybody.
I actually think
it does. Even if you're a little squeamish about this kind of thing, because, again, you kind of got to marvel at the craftsmanship of the practicality of these effects. And I can't say that as much with Evil Dead, because, or Dead Alive, excuse me, because that almost was vomit-inducing. That was a little gross. I will say that.
I mean, Dead Alive pushes the limits to the extreme, and Dead Alive, because it was a foreign film, it was a New Zealand film.
Right.
You could get away with pushing...
Not shackled by the MPAA.
Not shackled at all. Yeah. And I think that's what made it great.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I would never want to bash that or censor that.
And the thing about Reanimator that's great as well is that the unrated version kind of follows suit in that, where they are pushing the limits. Now, granted, we're talking about a very restrictive budget in comparison to Dead Alive, where Dead Alive has a $3 million budget and Reanimator has a $900,000 budget.
Very true.
And on top of that, there's a few more interesting things. The fact that the score, Richard Band's score, is basically Psycho.
It's totally a ripoff of
Psycho.
It's an absolute ripoff
of
Psycho.
Yeah, it's an absolute ripoff of Psycho. You could say it's paying homage to it, but...
It's a ripoff.
It's a ripoff of Psycho.
It's paying homage in the way that Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby was paying homage to Under Pressure.
Yeah.
It's Under Pressure.
And then another interesting thing is, so Stuart Gordon originally envisioned this to be a TV series. So Reanimator would have kind of been an early 80s horror TV show. But he was told that it wouldn't sell because in the early 80s, horror TV wasn't really popular. It wasn't something that you could, and plus with censorship.
I think they're kind of right.
Nowadays, I think Reanimator would make a fantastic television show.
It would be great now because we're in the golden age of television at this point. Back then, I don't think anybody would have ever wanted to see... It would have been a lot more tame. It would have been something like a 50s Frankenstein
right. Well,
monster.
And that's kind of what it was going to be. Because he was told to take the pilot that he had written for it and make it feature length, which is how we got the film that we have today. But his original version, he wanted to be in black and white, and he wanted it to be a period piece.
Okay.
Which would work for...
Again, that retro throwback
really
vibe,
well. But due to budgetary constraints, he updated it to modern day, got rid of the black and white. It was supposed to be filmed in Chicago, where he was from, but instead, due to the budgetary constraints, they ended up filming in L.A.
Makes sense. Those are more of those business decisions that you would have to concede.
It's interesting and cool to think of it. That's how this film came to be. It was a different idea completely and then turned into something and formed into what it became.
Of a lot of the domestic movies that we've actually talked about, this is probably one of the ones that come out a bit more unscathed by either censorship or Hollywood business decisions or other things, where it's like, okay, so you have a couple of versions of the film, but they were kind of only either because of pacing issues or too much violence. Just a little bit, though.
Oh, dude, showing the stuff that they show during the autopsy scenes, showing that type of stuff happen in it, they're not going to want to put that in a film. They're going to try and cut that as much as humanly possible. I know that the eyeballs exploding in the beginning were cut out of it. I know that some of the gore scenes dealing with the head and the body were cut a little bit. I know that some of the scenes at the end with all the dead bodies coming back were cut down some. And it was, it's a lot of realistic looking gore.
Exactly. But even if with the submission or the omission of that, you still have a good movie here.
Oh yeah.
And sometimes when we talk about movies like this, that maybe the effects are kind of the best thing that it has going for it, or maybe sometimes the only thing that it has going for it, you kind of want to see as much as you can, but I'm okay with seeing a little bit less of that because we still kind of have a great, briskly written, fun movie.
And see, the thing about that is that Bride of Reanimator, not so much.
In either respect.
You get Jean-Carl Beekler doing some of the special effects in there, and you get Screaming Mad George in there as well.
I have no idea who that is.
The effects in it are pretty cool. They do more of the body parts coming to life or body parts being attached to different things. There's a dog that gets killed, brought back. It has one of its paws or arms ripped off, and they put a human hand on it.
Right.
There's a whole thing. It's just like 5-minute sequence of all these different bodies appearing with different forms, like one body that's been split and put so the faces are on the front and the back.
Yeah.
You have a head on top of arms and legs moving around and all this cool shit. They take Carl Hill's head and put bat wings on it so it flies around. I mean, some of it looks super goofy and some of it's kind of fake. He puts an arm onto a leg and reanimates it.
Right.
That type of stuff was cool in it to a point. I mean, it was cool that they were able to do that, but the acting is atrocious, number one. The sound design doesn't sound very good in it. There's a lot of issues with how it sounds. And then you can see the quality of the footage doesn't match in certain scenes.
Yeah.
Very well for Bride of Reanimator. Things in it don't really gel. Some of the way that it's edited and some of the way that it's shot doesn't match up. So as far as a sequel goes, to me it feels extremely inferior.
Yeah, and it's a big testament to how good of a filmmaker you can make a film, or how good of a filmmaker you can be in order to make a film like Reanimator work as well as it does with all of the things that you had to take out of it.
Yeah.
Because if this was exactly what the director or the creators had envisioned, it would have been something very different. Probably would have still been good.
Mm-hmm.
But even now, with all of the things that you have to take out of it or concede for or make, you know, compromises for, it's still pretty great.
Yeah, I would say...
And that's kind of a great testament to how good of filmmakers and people around this first project were.
Yeah, I would say the omission of Stuart Gordon from the sequels is definitely a major detriment.
Yeah.
You can definitely see where the quality dips extremely.
Yeah.
I mean, I would suggest watch Bride of Reanimator after watching Reanimator just so you can appreciate Reanimator that much more. Now, then watch Beyond Reanimator, which is still, it's not bad. I would say it's better than Bride of Reanimator by far.
And probably a lot better than a lot of the films that you've subjected yourself to in your horror-watching career.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think that Beyond Reanimator would be that great. It was early 2000s. It had been a while. It was Brian Usna again doing the directing, but it's a decent film.
Certainly not trash,
yeah,
by any means.
I think they were going to try and do House of Reanimator, where Herbert West was going to be in the White House.
Oh, God. Oh, yes. Oh, no.
That never came into fruition. I think there was budgetary issues with that, and it just never got off the ground. And I think that's probably for the best. I mean, we could still see another Reanimator. I know they're doing another Reanimator film. It's not gonna have Jeffrey Combs though as Herbert West. He is Herbert West.
And for all of the films of that he's been in, like, you may as well put him in there, but
you may as well, but it's been, you know, 32 years since Reanimator.
Yeah.
A much older Herbert West who somehow keeps avoiding death in every single film.
Of course. That's the signature to the character.
Yeah.
But, from what we have here for the first Reanimator, I think we can easily recommend this one as well.
Absolutely, yeah. This is one of those films that's not for the squeamish. But if you can handle, you know, the sexual perversity of it and the gore.
Right.
Then, yeah, I think it's a great time. I mean, it's definitely a twist on the Frankenstein tale.
Yeah, man. This is probably one of the better... I guess 80s throwbacks that you can see from the 80s to the 50s.
Sure.
Which is a weird thing to think about because you actually kind of have to put your film goer lens on for thinking about what a throwback to the 50s would look like in the 80s.
Right. Well, I mean, John Carpenter's The Thing was a
exactly.
remake of, you know, It Came from Another World or It Came from Another Planet or The Thing from Another World. And that was a great re-envisioning of what it was, and it was based on the story Who Goes There. Like, it was fantastic. It really, a lot of the stuff that came out in the 80s were remakes of the films from the 50s. The Blob, 1988, Chuck Russell's film, was a remake of The Blob from the 50s, and it's a great, great film. It seems like every 30 years, they decide to go and remake stuff that existed during that time to showcase what it is now. I feel like what they're doing today is remaking 80s films, but throwing a thick-ass layer of CG on it.
Exactly,
which is what's kind of ruining it.
So if you want to know the trends of yesteryear, it would most likely be stuff like in Reanimator.
Yeah, and stuff from the 80s. I would say out of all the Frankenstein films, and there's a lot of them that go off of that story in general, if you want something that does push things to the extreme, but it is a whole lot of fun at the same time, and is a film that pretty high quality, I would say.
Oh, for sure.
Then you're going to want to go with Reanimator.
Absolutely. Well, that is going to do it for us here at Oh The Horror. You can feel free to check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts now as you're listening to this right here. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and everything that you can find. So feel free to email us questions or suggestions for the show at ohthehorrorcast@gmail.com. And we will be seeing you guys next week. I have been Stephen Allman.
And I'm Rob Holmes.
And we'll see you next time.
Look at me, Damien. It's all for you.
Time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
When there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk here.